Welcome back to the D-Fly and Dixie podcast featuring Big Ten Network, ESPN, and Inside Lacrosse analyst, and my old friend, Mark Dixon. I am the host, Dan Flynn. There's so much to talk about. Quarterfinal games on tap. So, Dixie, let's get it. Dix, we brought in a special guest this week. Quarterfinal action is so big this week. We brought in our old friend from Inside Lacrosse, Christian Sweezy. He's also the author of a new book called We Showed Baltimore, The Lacrosse Revolution of the 1970s and Richie Moran's Big Red. Christian, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you very much for having me, both you guys. It's wonderful to be here.
People like Christian from his appearance a couple weeks ago so much that the fan mail was piling up saying you got to get that the author back on. So welcome, Christian. It's a gigantic week, quarterfinal week. And we're glad you could join us for a few minutes.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, when you were on a few weeks ago, I've always enjoyed talking to you, and you're just so knowledgeable, and you're a different voice than we usually get on some Inside Lacrosse podcasts. That, you know, so I said, we gotta have him back on, and I thought this was the perfect opportunity. So welcome aboard. You guys watched the games this weekend. The epic fail that so many people predicted did not happen. In fact, it was an incredible first weekend of the tournament. There were some fantastic games. Christian, you were at the Georgetown-Delaware game. We'll get to that. But really what was most impressive was the atmosphere and the great crowds. Just star performances, great crowds on campus.
I think you saw it in the conference championship games. We talked about Hawk Hill, St. Joe's, and then the scene at Vermont. What it made me think was, wow, like when you think it's good, like the weather is always relative to your mindset. If you get, if it's not windy or if it's not like, you know, frigid, you feel like March is okay. April gets better. But these last 2 weeks have been really, really awesome. And the atmosphere, there were several really great atmospheres. The one that I really took away and enjoyed was USAC Field at Rutgers. That's a place where the Scarlet Knights played for a long time before moving into their stadium. And that's an environment that just lent itself to a great atmosphere. A lot of the students, you could tell they were riled up. You could tell they were excited. And that grass surface just kind of hit different. It reminded me of like Brown, when Brown used to host the NCAA championships. And I don't want to take anything away from College Park, but that grass at Maryland used to get really worn, where it was a lot more plush up at Brown. So I love the atmospheres of this past weekend. They were really, a couple venues were really, really showed out.
Yes, no, I agree. I was pleased to see the competitive games with you. I love the crowd. I love the enthusiasm. You know, that Georgetown-Delaware game, I was fortunate enough to cover. And even with the 45-minute weather delay, you know, the weather delay happened right at the beginning. And I thought, well, this game's on TV. It's Sunday night. The place was packed when it restarted, you know, 7:30 started. They wound up postponing until 8:18, and it was a tremendous crowd. And so I think, you know, even that 7:30 Sunday night game can be a little bit iffy at times, but that was, you know, committee hit a home run on that one. Delaware showed up and Georgetown showed up. It was a good game.
The one venue I was not excited to see was Penn Park, because Franklin Field is just Franklin Field. But I got to tell you, Penn Park was lit. Yeah, people. You could see there were like areas that were fenced off, roped off. People had coolers. There were cocktail tables out. People were getting after it at Penn. So that was another cool venue.
And I enjoyed too, after Hanley scored, or whoever scored one of those late goals, and they sort of went over to where the Richmond fans were seated. You know, there was a little bit of a back and forth between some of the players and some of the fans that, you know, I think adds to a little bit of the atmosphere for sure.
Well, there will be some great atmospheres at the two quarterfinal locations this weekend. We will get to that. But before we get to that, I want to get to the Inside Lacrosse All-America teams came out, and players who balled out all season were recognized. And to the victors go the spoils. Georgetown with four members on the first team, Graham Bundy, Zach Geddes, Will Bowen, and Owen McElroy, all first team Inside Lacrosse All-Americans. But Maryland with five first-teamers and 12 overall guys, highlighted by Logan Wisnowskis. They even had three short-stick defensive midfielders who made All-American. just unprecedented.
It's a loaded team, and they're perfect so far this year in every way. Big quarterfinal matchup this coming weekend against Virginia, and I've fielded a few communications this week, text, conversation, whatever. And they're like, look, if Virginia can't beat Maryland, then it's over. You know, Maryland's going to win the championship. I thought Georgetown was a team that could take down the Terps, and they're no longer in the tournament, upset by Delaware. So I think anything is possible. But, I mean, Dan, you and I talked about it a few weeks ago when all Big Ten was announced. You know, 8 Terrapins were on the team. Then we found out you can only nominate 8. You could have gone 10, 12 deep with Maryland on the all Big Ten team. But no, it's always cool to look at the, you know, look at the all inside lacrosse team. I tell you, that brings up something that I wanted to talk about with you guys. So Connor Schellenberger named a Tuorton finalist this year, only a second team All-American, according to the wisdom of inside lacrosse. Is Schellenberger a worthy Tuorton finalist? We know he's an amazing player, but I think he's missed some time because of injury and been slowed down a little bit this year. So what are your thoughts on Schellenberger being the Tuorton finalist?
I didn't mind it because, as the people of Virginia say, you know, he's somebody who can dominate a game with the ball barely being in his stick. You know, he dictates so many things. He's such an accurate shooter. He's such an accurate passer, but he doesn't run the offense. You know, I feel like Dixon 10 went D-I-C-K-S, went different spelling from yours, Mark. But I feel like he does a lot of the offense behind. They invert a lot. You know, they use a lot of different midfield lines, use a lot of different personnel. And so I didn't mind Schellenberger being there because, as you know, I think Virginia is sort of the last best chance to beat Maryland. Sorry to Yale, who's probably next on that list for me, but significantly further down. And so I didn't mind that the best player on, you know, probably the best chance to beat Maryland is on that list.
There's always a few cases like that where you see something, you're like, well, how can this guy be there, that guy be there? And one name that kind of jumped out to me that's missing from here is Brown goalie Connor Terrio was the first team all Ivy goalie and didn't make even honorable mention. Dartmouth's Danny Hinks did. Not to say Danny Hinks isn't deserving of honorable mention, but generally, if you're the top player at your position in one of the league all-conference teams, you generally make it onto the All-American list, and his name didn't show up.
Although he did get a T-shirt after him. Terrio did get that the People's Goalie T-shirt with the American flag on it. So I that's not a bad consolation prize. And he's only a sophomore, so he'll get chances. You know, I saw him play against Cornell earlier this year, a significant win by Brown. And I was very impressed that he sort of read angles, but it looked like he was kind of baiting shooters a little bit too. You know, CJ Kearse, the very talented freshman from Cornell, went 1 for 16 shooting in that game, but 8 of the shots were on goal. It wasn't like it was raining and his stick was off and he was putting stuff on cage, but Terrio just was reading those stick angles. And, you know, he's kind of a bigger guy, takes up a lot of the cage. I'm with you. I probably would have had him in there somewhere. Just having seen him in person, I found him very impressive. And again, that he's only a sophomore. He'll be around for a couple more years. And he has a twin brother who plays at one of the D3 programs as an attackman. And their body types are completely different. I looked it up because their father is a Division III coach in New England. And the brother's like 6'2", like, you know, 180. And Terrio is not either. He's more than 180 and less than 6'2".
How can you leave the People's Goalie off this list? Anytime someone's gotten the moniker of the People's Goalie, you got to have them on the list. But no, I agree with everything Christian said. Look, you know, it is what it is. All-American lists are a lot like, you know, the IL media list is a lot like the poll. You know, it's up for debate. It's fun to talk about, but it's not the end-all, be-all. But a lot of great players made the team.
You know who's not represented at all, Vince?
I know where you're going with this. Get ready. Get ready for your little get your violin out, Christian, because here it comes.
There are so many Maryland players on this. There's a guy, and I'm apologizing to him right now, long stick midfielder John Geppert. I don't know who you are. I think I know every other guy that's listed on here. I'm not sure who you are. And you're so good you made honorable mention. And not a single Hopkins Blue Jay is on the IL All-American list. And that
Geppert's a stud, man. I can't believe
he's a great athlete.
If you watch Sunday night on BTN, you saw Geppert show out a couple times.
There's just so many names to remember with Maryland that he has escaped my zeitgeist. And I apologize to him. And it really, the point is, what I'm trying to making is I'd love to see some Blue Jays on there. And I hope that changes in the future.
Well, speaking of which, how about the big Blue Jay news this week? Yeah. John Grant Jr., offensive coordinator, no longer on the staff.
You know, I don't know that it was necessarily a surprise. I wound up sitting as a fan for the first round Big Ten game at Homewood Field between Penn State and Johns Hopkins. It was a old school, you know, Saturday, 2 o'clock start, not on TV, beautiful weather, late April at Homewood Field. And we thought, well, let's go. And so we went and we wound up sitting behind the Blue Jays bench and it was a nice crowd. And actually a lot of students were there, which was nice to see. But at the end of the third quarter, Grant Jr. had his water bottle kind of, you know, near behind where the team was sitting, and he went to go grab a drink of water, and Millman had his water bottle there too, and they both grabbed drinks of water. They were standing within 2 feet of each other, never acknowledged each other, never said hi, never said anything. And at that time I thought, oh, well, that's not the way it usually goes, especially because Hopkins was winning. You know, they would have been presumably in a much better mood. But one of the things too, talking to the Cornell people, as I've done, you know, a few times over the past 2 years with that book project, but just sort of asking about Peter Millman, and one of the things I was told was that he gives a lot of leeway to his assistants, you know, and that's one reason why people think Connor Musick has done such a good job as a first year head coach, first time head coach, getting Cornell into the quarterfinals and still alive, is that he's had a lot of responsibility thrown at him. And that's not to say Millman is lazy. That's quite the opposite. I think he is a people, you know, that he trusts the people around him to make decisions. And I think that that is something that, you know, if you have a very good offensive coordinator, then that stuff is going to help you. So I'm curious who they would hire. And I think they have some talent coming in. I think Garrett Degnan might even be back for a fifth year at Johns Hopkins. So whoever does come in with some freshmen and Degnan, I think would have some pieces to work with.
I think when Junior was hired, there were two schools of thought. One, this is going to be a genius hire. This is going to be a legend that is going to impart his wisdom on a newer generation of player, or it was going to be a disaster. And I think it's somewhere in between. You know, I don't want to be insulting to the point where you say it's been a disaster, but it certainly didn't work out as the former thought either. You know, look, at the end of the day, it's Peter Milliman's offense. I don't care who's running it, who's in charge of it, how much leeway you get. And I guess Coach Milliman didn't feel like that offense was run to the efficiency or to the level that he wanted it run as. The other thing that we've talked about a lot here, Dan, and Christian, if you've listened, we've made comments, and I'll make it again here. Where is the Hopkins program? Dan and I as graduates, myself as a lacrosse alum, I feel like the program needs to come out and make some type of statement. Whether the gripes, rumors, innuendos, chatter is accurate or not, there's a lot of questions surrounding the program. Mainly doing with how dedicated is the school to the Johns Hopkins men's lacrosse program. And we feel like there should be some type of statement made, or, you know, almost like a State of the Union kind of address. Potentially, maybe this is one of those changes. You know, oftentimes when a coach is on a hot seat or under the microscope, they're forced to make changes, or they're encouraged to make changes, or maybe they just want to make changes on their own. And oftentimes, you know, we equate this a lot of times to like NFL football or college football. You know, a coordinator is let go, offensive or defensive. And maybe that's the case with John Grant Jr.
Well, I was surprised too, Dixie, to your point. I covered or attended at least a half dozen Johns Hopkins games, probably four at home and two on the road. And I only saw President Daniels. I don't think I saw him at any of them, but I do think he was at homecoming, which I missed. But it was, I was so surprised that President Daniels wasn't in that little box that's sort of next to the press box. And if I were a Hopkins fan, I'd be a little bit concerned about that. The athletic director, I think, was at several of the games. I certainly saw her at the Johns Hopkins Navy game, and she had a long talk with Peter Millman afterwards. So I think she is aware of what's going on. But I was very surprised that President Daniels wasn't at some of those games.
Well, it certainly makes for an interesting beginning of the offseason for the Blue Jays, and that'll be a key hire for them moving forward. And your concerns and comments are understood from both. Well said. All right, let's get to why everybody tunes in to hear us. We're going to talk about food, movies, and music. But first, we got to cover some games. So let's get to the quarterfinal games are on Saturday and Sunday. All the games are on ESPNU. The first one up on Saturday, May 21st from Hempstead, New York, will be number 3, Penn. 11-4 overall. They got here by beating Richmond in overtime, 11-10 last weekend. They will face the number 6 seeded Rutgers Scarlet Knights. They are 14-3 overall on the season. They dispatched Harvard 19-9 last weekend. And that game will be at noon.
All right, I'll go first. Okay, Penn. I've been frustrated with Penn all year, but I liked what I saw out of them this past weekend against Richmond. The poor Spires, one failed clear away from advancing to the quarterfinals. Where have we heard that before? Oh, yeah, 2021. Loyola, one failed clear away from getting it across and beating Duke going to championship weekend last year. Rutgers, all they had to do was clear it, right? And get it into offensive end. Chris Gray had other plans, though. Creates a turnover, Carolina goes down, boom, they go to championship weekend. Someone even sent me a text and went as far back as 2009. Max Seabaugh and Cornell, they clear that ball. They win a national championship for Jeff Tambroni, the then coach of the Big Red. So, you know, but players make plays. And Penn made the play, forced the turnover, got the game-tying goal. Ben Smith, 5 goals. Sam Hanley looks like a different player from when I saw him against St. Joe's just, 2 weeks ago. I thought Hanley was a little bit passive. He was so aggressive this past weekend, and he's a matchup nightmare. So it's going to be interesting to see how Rutgers defends him. How about the Scarlet Knights? They did Jersey proud with the big crowd and the vibrant atmosphere. Ross Scott went off for 8 goals. I thought Colin Kearse was really good. They faced off incredibly well, which has been an Achilles heel of them, you know, throughout the years, but, you know, also here in 2022. And I think this is going to be a pro Rutgers crowd in Hempstead by far. So they feed off of that. I mean, these guys, the Rutgers Scarlet Knights, feed off of that type of support, that type of atmosphere. So it should be a terrific game. Between the Quakers and the Scarlet Knights.
And I'm curious to see what Rutgers does with Hanley. I think it'll probably be Rawl, the long stick midi, who takes him if Hanley's coming out of the box. That's a pretty good matchup right there. You know, I agree with you. It's Kearse, and it's not only Kearse, the Rutgers goalie making saves, but him jump starting that out, his outlet passes and jump starting transition. You know, Penn is the only team I've found in a while averaging less than 40 shots a game. Now it's 39 point something, but it is under 40 shots a game. And I do think that Rutgers is going to want to run. I think Penn wants to play it a little bit slow, make sure Hanley gets in the game, make sure he gets his touches, make sure Gregar gets his touches. I was very surprised that Ben Smith, as you mentioned earlier, Dixie, who scored 5 goals in that game, had only scored 19 leading up to that. You know, he was probably a bit hurt and some things going on, but you know, Penn, I was talking to a D1 head coach toward the end of the regular season. And I said, who's the best team you've seen either in person or on film? And he said, Penn. So I think that, yeah, you know, I don't know. My guess is Rutgers, but Penn has certainly impressed a lot of people.
They have. And I think they're much more athletic than people give them credit for. And Birkinshaw, between the pipes, I'm not sold on him. I don't know. I'm not sold on Patrick Birkinshaw. He's been good. He's been bad. But you can say the same thing about Colin Kearse. I feel like Kearse plays down to or up to the competition. And I think that's why he's had success in the Big Ten tournament and in the NCAA tournament, is because he raises his game. So both these goaltenders are going to have to be on point. Face-offs will be interesting. But I think you're right, Christian. I think that up-tempo style. And I really think Zach Frankowiak has been playing out of his mind the last couple of weeks. I thought he was terrific in the Big Ten tournament. And I thought he had a sterling effort last weekend as well. You know, Penn, though, they just, man, Gabe Fury can step up and win you a game. Dylan Gregar can step up and make plays. So this will be a fun game. This will be a really fun game. What'd you guys think of the I know we'll probably go through this, but like 6 Ivy League teams. What'd you think in the first round? I mean, I think I talked to Mike Preston about that this week from the Baltimore Sun. You had what? Princeton and Cornell dominated. Penn and Yale were in dogfights, but won. And then Brown and Harvard just, you know, I thought they showed well for good parts of the game, but then they just kind of ran out of gas in the end. What do you guys think? Committee vindicated or committee should be burned down, as some talking heads said.
I don't know. I think the door was left open by Harvard losing and Virginia, who wasn't seeded and got a home game, all winning on the road against Brown, just enough to keep that conversation open.
Yeah, I agree. And I still think, you know, Duke with those losses, I kind of get that one. But I agree with Anish Shroff when he said, you know, Notre Dame was a team that he could have seen dogpiling on Memorial Day after winning the championship, and they didn't even get a chance to get in. And someone told me, a D1 coach told me, he said, look, this tournament should be about who are the 18 best teams, who are the teams that can win a national title. And he thought that the exclusion of Duke to a certain extent, but Notre Dame for certain, was an exclusion of a team that could win the national title. So I don't know. I actually don't mind. I sort of understood the committee's decisions. That's not to say I agreed with them, but I sort of understood where they were coming from. But, you know, if we wanted to say, well, who are the best 18 teams, I think Notre Dame would have shown a little bit better than certainly Harvard.
In any case, Penn and Rutgers will play at noon on Saturday, and I'm predicting a one-goal game. Penn has played 7 one-goal games, won 5 of them.
Yeah.
Rutgers has won 4 one-goal games.
I'm very excited to watch Frankowiak and then Piper for Penn, the very good short stick, the middies. You know, one of the things in that Georgetown game against Delaware from the first round that I was fortunate enough to cover, you know, Georgetown's Will Godin, a junior, missed the game. One of their best short stick D-middies, Sam Geddes, were amazing D-middies, and Georgetown so rarely had to slide to those matchups. And Godin missed the game, but it looked like a hand injury, looked like he had a cast on his hand. And Delaware went right after his replacements. I mean, that you know, 4 goals just on those dodges. And even, you know, that final possession with a minute left, Delaware called timeout and they had the entire shot clock with which to work. And you could tell they're going to take the shorty behind who isn't Geddes, who isn't 13. They're going to take that other short stick behind and dodge. And that's what they did. And they hit the winner that way. So, you know, those, if you have, and you, as we said, Maryland with 3 short stick D-middies as IL All-Americans, you know, if you have 1 or 2 of those guys, it makes a big difference. And both Rutgers and Penn have that.
And real quick, we'll talk about this down the line, but what team lost one of their short stick D-middies last year in the postseason? And it came back to haunt them. Maryland, Jake Higgins.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. And it really hurt them on Memorial Day against Virginia. So that's a great
point.
Forgot
about that.
In the second game of the day from Hempstead at 2:30, number 4 Yale, they're 12-4 on the season. They outlasted St. Joe's 18-16. On Saturday, they will play number 5 seeded Princeton, 10-4 on the season, who methodically beat Boston University 12-5 last Saturday. And this is a rematch from an earlier Ivy League game on March 26th when Yale beat Princeton 14-12 in the rain.
You know, I've seen Princeton in person. I saw them play Georgetown earlier this season. I was amazed at how athletic they are. You know, Song, the long stick, the midi, 32, is so athletic. You know, Bond, 17, Finley, 10. You know, they have a nice rotation of defensemen, you know, and even to the point where one of the defensemen was hurt, I think it was actually Bond, and they had to bring in a completely new defenseman, hadn't started at all, had played very briefly, and he was terrific against Georgetown. You know, Princeton won that game 10-8, and Georgetown's attack was extremely quiet. So Princeton has athletes, and they have depth on defense, which I think is kind of unusual to have both of those things. You know, the offense, settled offense, I'm not positive they're there. I also, you know, I think there's question marks about Yale's defense. I think there's question marks about Yale's goalie. They may very well be good, but from what I've seen, I don't think that they're as good as maybe I was expecting. And going back to the short stick D-middie conversation, you know, when Yale won it in 2018, Warner and Alessi, their 2 short stick D-middies, remember in the title game against Duke, Alessi, who was playing more offense that year, but he was almost exclusively defense in that title game. And remember, he was the football player. He was the cornerback, starting cornerback on the football team, and just such a good athlete. And I think that really does go to show that you're willing to give, you know, take a second line midi off that rotation and have him play exclusively defense. That does go to show how important those defensive midfield positions are. But I was very impressed with Princeton 2-way middies, which seems to be a thing of the past. I still think Yale wins. I think Yale has the mentality, the mental edge. They play so hard. You know, they're so tough, and they will run through a brick wall for that program and for Coach Shea, and credit to Coach Shea for getting guys who play that hard. So I don't make predictions, but my guess is that how hard Yale plays is going to be an issue for Princeton.
How about Princeton, what they did to Boston University last weekend? I mean, BU is a good team, and watching them, it was tough. It was painful because they, for whatever reason, whether it was Princeton's effort, game plan, or BU's nerves or lack of execution, whatever it was, Princeton just dominated that game. And then Yale, of course, had to fight down to the wire to take care of St. Joe's, who's proven to be an incredible team in 2022. You look back at this previous meeting won by Yale by a couple of goals. It was a sloppy game. And Princeton can look at a couple of things that did them in that day. They were only 17 out of 24 on clears, and they were 1 for 5 on the EMO, and they turned the ball over 23 times. You clean up one of those areas. You'd like to clean up all three, but if you clean up one of those areas, you probably win that game. Yale also made 19 saves that day. So if you're Princeton and the way you're playing right now, then you couple it with your last meeting, you're like, guys, we really kind of did ourselves in. I mean, give credit, all the credit in the world to Yale. I mean, that's a hell of a team. And they are a team that when I've watched them 3-4 times this year, when they decide to impose their will on another team physically, there's no one in the country really that does it better than the Bulldogs. So for me, Princeton's just got to clean up a couple things, and they can't give Yale opportunity. If you're the Bulldogs, you know, you've got to be Yale, you know, in this game. You've got to use your experience from the playoffs. You're the one that has the more star-studded lineup. And you just have to execute. And defensively, wow. I mean, the Bulldogs still continue to struggle, especially on the interior. It was prevalent last week against the Hawks. They really need to tighten things up on the defensive end.
To your point, Dixie, about the St. Joe's game, remember the only time Yale trailed in the 2018 NCAA tournament when they won the title was in the first round game against UMass. UMass jumped on them a little bit early. So, you know, I, Virginia in 06, that was such a coronation, for lack of a better term. But remember, they struggled in the first round against Notre Dame. It was a 14-10 game, and Kemp, the Notre Dame goalie, played amazing. So, you know, those first round games, I totally get where you're coming from, but, you know, not always, you're going to struggle somewhere, you know, and for some teams, it's the first round. So, I'm very interested to see this game. I think they're pretty similar teams, and a lot of his mindset.
Well, that's why Dan and I talk about the eye test a lot. When people say you need to use the eye test for the NCAA tournament, this game, this sport can be so different from week to week. When did you watch the team play? Because if you're watching BU last week, you're thinking, what? You know, I mean, I know they're an AQ, but you're like, this team doesn't belong. But then you watch them play against Army in the Patriot League championship game, you're like, wow, this team's a completely different ball club. So that's the danger of the eye test. But no, you're right. I mean, you know, this thing is week to week, and teams take on different personalities and have different mojo in each game.
These two teams definitely know each other. One thing is, Yale gives up to so many goals. They've only held one team to under 10 goals all season, and that was in a 23-6 win over Dartmouth. Princeton didn't get much out of three of their top guys. Chris Brown and Slusher only had 2 goals and no assists in the first meeting, and Sammy English was held scoreless. So if they get the normal production out of really who I think are like their 3-star offensive players, it could be a very different game. Very different game this time. Let's move on to Sunday's action in Columbus, Ohio. I think, Christian, you're going to be there covering the game.
I will, Lord willing, yes.
Awesome. And two teams that you know fairly well are number 7 Cornell and unseeded Delaware, who play at noon. Cornell is 12-4 on the season. They beat Ohio State 15-8 last Sunday to get here. Unseeded Delaware with the big upset of the tournament so far. They are 13-5 overall. The game's at noon. And there's a lot of storylines in this game.
Yes, there are. And one of the things that really impressed me about Delaware, having seen them in person on Sunday night for the first time, you know, it was the middle of the third quarter, and I was looking on the field, and I said, I cannot tell which of these teams is the number 2 seed and which of them is the unseeded one who had to play a play-in game 72 hours earlier just to get here. You know, Delaware has a lot of confidence, and they're very I was impressed. You know, Georgetown goes on runs, and they can get goals, and Delaware never really let them do that. Georgetown got back-to-back goals, you know, once, maybe twice in that game, but that was it. And every time Georgetown gave up a goal and you thought, well, here's where the run comes, you know, Delaware was very composed. You know, there was no panic at all. I actually thought Georgetown was the more nervous of the two teams. I really think people watching that game, if you didn't know who was the number two and who was the unseeded, you would have had a hard time guessing just by watching how they played. So I was very impressed with Ben DeLuca and the job. Of course, you remember he took Cornell to the Final Four in 2013. So I was very impressed with him and the job he did getting his team. You know, he kept harping on the word belief or believe, you know, some version of that. I mean, at least a half dozen times post game. So, you know, those are guys who believe in themselves. These two teams are so similar to me because they're very top heavy. You know, the three attackmen account for so much of the offense and so much of the shooting. And so I'm very curious to see how that shakes out. You know, Delaware's three starting attackmen are fantastic. I think they're all three have more than 40 goals. For Cornell, has two with at least 49. And then Long, the third, is a 30-30 type guy. I think he's 28 and 29 goals and assists. So for me, it's, you know, the knowns. You defend the knowns the way John Tillman and Lars Tiffany always say, defend the knowns, or Bill Belichick, I guess, is the first one to say it. Defend the knowns, and who are the unknowns? And for me, you know, I really like Delaware's midfield. They got some points out of Linkaitis the other night, including an assist on the game-winning goal. And I love Kelleher from Cornell, 27. It seems like he's a big kid. I was surprised he only has 19 goals in 16 games. He's a kid on the eye test who looks like he would have 25 or 30, because what I love about Kelleher, 27, is he's so big, he's able to get into the middle of the field. He's able to get between the hash marks for his shots. And if those shots fall, they're going to be trouble for Delaware. So I think these are two teams that are pretty similar, and two very good defensemen. Adler, 77 for Cornell, I think was a first teamer and well-deserved. And Grant, 81 from Delaware, is tremendous. And even talking about the game plan, you know, Georgetown's leading scorer, Dylan Watson, 58 goals this year. And my nephew, who's a sophomore at Gonzaga, was the one who pointed this out to me. On faceoffs, because they didn't want Watson shooting it unsettled, Grant, their best defender, was on Watson. And the minute it went to 6-on-6, Grant went over to Haley and they short-sticked Watson. And so the fact that they were able to switch like that on the fly, given 72 hours to prepare, really impressed me.
I think one of the things that was missed in the broadcast was the familiarity between Georgetown and Delaware. Matt Rakowski was an assistant to Kevin Warren for 5 years in D.C. And then those two teams scrimmaged back in January. And I think Delaware was able to take both those experiences and really apply it to the game on Sunday night. And I thought that as the game went on, to your point, Christian, you saw Delaware just kind of swelling with confidence. And it looked like Georgetown was starting to tighten up a little bit. And I was watching the game with my son Matt, and I'm just like, Dylan Watson hasn't like done anything in this game, and you know, he watched his Loyola Greyhounds team get lit up by Watson, so that was really, really great game planning by the Blueheads.
And the other thing too, Dix, is real quick, you know, no one knew that Godin was not going to play. That was a very last minute thing. Right. I think he'd been injured in practice. And all of a sudden, Delaware realized, hey, 10's not out there. Let's start dodging on 16, 18, and 40, and to a certain extent, 13, 2, Geddes. But, you know, I was so impressed that they were able to pick that up right away. And again, four goals came against the short 60 middies, and the dodge at the end that led to the assist for the winning goal also came against the short 60 middie. You know, I don't think they went in saying, well, let's dodge against 10, let's do this, let's do that. They recognized what the situation was and adapted. I was very impressed.
You can see the aggressiveness of Delaware in their one-on-one matchups in the fourth quarter. And I was even texting with some people and I was like, oh boy, you know, Delaware starting to win their matchups. I said, look for JP Ward off ball. And guess what he does? He scores the final two goals of the game. Now the game tying goal wasn't an off ball. It was a you know, rebound and then a pass to him. But then, scramble. You know, of course, Ward was, you know, the off ball goal to end things in regulation. But, you know, you could see them, you know, they were not afraid to dodge and really dodge to score. They weren't even like dodging to draw slides. Like, they were dodging to score, which was unbelievable. And this is a Delaware team that we talked about it last week, that they were pissed that they had to play the play-in game. They thought maybe St. Joe's could have played in that play-in game, particularly because the Blue Hens beat the Hawks head-to-head early in the season. So they'd carried that chip on their shoulder. And I covered that 07 Virginia-Delaware game where the Blue Hens knocked off the Cavaliers in Charlottesville with Virginia being the two. But that was a much different situation than this game. Virginia was banged up. They had injuries they weren't that good. You know, they weren't like, I think they kind of were gifted that number two versus a four or a five that year. But this was a Georgetown team that we were like, yeah, this team could win the national championship. That's how good they are. And you know, maybe if these two teams play 10 times, Georgetown wins nine, but Sunday was that 10th game. And Delaware pulled it out. Cornell, how similar of a script was it from the March meeting with Ohio State in Ithaca, where the Buckeyes got out to a 3-4 goal lead? And then after that, Cornell just dominated the game. CJ Kearse was terrific. Adler was another, Gavin Adler did another fantastic job on Jack Myers. You know, really, really impressive victory. And that was a game that was like start, stop, you know, with all the weather delays. And obviously, I think that hurts the visiting team more, you know, being in unfamiliar territory. I thought that benefited Cornell, but that wasn't the reason the game was won or lost. The reason the game was won or lost is because Cornell just played very aggressively and they just kept coming. You know, I think they kind of smelled blood in the water. I don't know if, can you smell blood in the water? I don't know if you can smell it, but you can
Sure can.
sense the blood in the water, and they attacked, you know, and just finished the job. So, you know, another storyline. I mean, you know, Captain Obvious, but DeLuca, you know, coached at Cornell for what, 3 seasons, and you know, that wasn't a great ending for him. You know, maybe something to prove against the Big Red this weekend.
The Hens have won seven straight games. And I think it's an unusual stat that of the teams, the five teams who have knocked off a number two seed, the Hens have done it twice, first in 2007 and now this year. Christian, how do you think these two teams match up, and what are some of the individual battles that we should be looking for?
I'm very curious to see where Delaware puts Grant, 81, their best defenseman. I suspect it would be on Kearse, but maybe Piattelli, because Piattelli is so strong and so physical and such a good dodger. And you know, does Delaware try to short an attackman the way they did with Dylan Watson? It certainly worked. You know, again, not all the time, but in every 6-on-6, they were shorting him and face guarded him at times. And Watson only took five shots, didn't score. You know, it's a 58 goals this season guy who you held to zero with a short stick. So I'm curious, you know, A, where does 81 go matchup wise, and will they short one of the attackmen? And also, I love Bardwell from Cornell, 17, the short stick D middie on the other side, because you know, if Delaware tries to attack a short stick again the way they did against Georgetown, you know, I don't think it'll be 17. I think Broadwell's pretty good. I think Cornell needs to be ready for that.
And the final quarterfinal game of the week probably saved the best for last as number one overall seed Maryland. They're 15-0. They blew out Vermont 21-5 last Sunday in the first round. They will face unseeded Virginia in a rematch of an earlier game this season. Virginia, again, 12-3 on the season. They beat Brown on Saturday night, 17-10. This game will be at 2:30. Early in the season, Dixie, you called their first game where Terps won 23-12 back in March in front of a huge crowd at Audi Field. Seven Terps had at least two goals, and they got good play, especially from their faceoff man, Luke Wierman. I'll let you have the first crack at this matchup, Dixie.
Regular season matchup, that was a pick 'em. And all week and leading up to Joe B and I calling that one, it was, who do you think? Who do you think? And I kept like, you know, Maryland's the best team. I think Maryland is the best team, but I could see Virginia winning this game. Then when you really started to drill down, you're like, Maryland is so balanced. They have so many guys that could hurt you. And Virginia really is top heavy with Schellenberger and Matt Moore. And that's how that game kind of played out. I think Schellenberger and Moore combined for six of the, you know, half the team's goals. And no one really in a secondary role stepped up. But my biggest takeaway from that game was Maryland played that entire 60 minutes like their hair was on fire. They never stopped. Every ground ball, every ride, every clear, every shot, everything, they just dominated. You know, they were all over it. I understand Virginia was a little banged up. They had a couple guys coming back from injury, but man, you know, people call Virginia's defense Jurassic Park. I mean, they made Maryland made them look more like Seal Island. I mean, they just ran by Virginia all day long. Do I expect that to happen again? Probably not. Wierman won over 60% of the faceoffs. He was a man possessed in that game. Matt Nunes was a freshman, you actually started to feel a little bit sorry for him in the second half until he was eventually and smartly taken out of the game. But, you know, the psychological part of this game, Virginia's got that. You know, Virginia is living rent-free in Maryland's head. And I do think that that was mitigated somewhat by this shellacking that the Terps put on the Cavaliers back in March, but it's back again. You know, that was a situation where, yeah, if we lose the game, of course we'll be disappointed, but you know, our season is going to continue on. This is, you win, you advance, you lose and you go home. So I'm interested to see the approach of Maryland but I expect them to continue to be aggressive. And this was Keegan Codd's coming out party as well. I mean, he'd only had a handful of goals leading up to that game, and they scored four, a lot of them one-on-one against Virginia. So do I expect Maryland to win by that big of a margin? No, but I do think the Terps are just too much to handle in 2022.
Maryland is one of those teams, and we've seen them before, where you can play really, really well for 45 minutes and still lose by four goals because of what Maryland does in that 15 minutes is just completely off the charts. Virginia, the one thing I, if I were a Virginia fan, the one thing that would make me a little bit more confident about this, in the regular season meeting, Virginia, I think, was a little banged up. You know, I think that the Sostad was just coming off an injury against North Carolina. He had a kind of a knee injury. And I think Khan's early goals were against Sostad. You know, Sostad was still kind of feeling his way from that knee injury. I think LaSala was coming off an injury, or maybe was injured in that game. I think LaSala's healthy now. I think Sostad certainly looked much better against Brown the other night. So you know, again, I don't make predictions. I'm not here to make predictions. But Maryland is so good. But, you know, if I'm a Virginia fan, I'm certainly saying, well, this will be different from 23-12. And if I'm a Maryland coach, I'm telling my guys, this is going to be different from 23-12. That doesn't mean Virginia's going to win, but I think it's going to be a much closer game. And look, if you're Maryland, you know, I get that Virginia's living rent free, but if you're Maryland, you're saying, well, without that shot that hit the goal, the crossbar that counted as a goal on Hofstra, maybe we win that one. And, you know, last year came down to the final seconds. You know, maybe they can send that one into overtime with a little bit of a different look off that face off in the final seconds. So I think this is a very, very interesting game. And I think that, you know, the one thing I would keep coming back to is John Tillman's record in quarterfinals with a week to prepare. He is death to opponents. And that's one of the things that I think is going to be very interesting to see sort of what tweaks he comes up with based on this Virginia team that, again, I think is a little bit more healthy than the one they faced at Audi Field.
Virginia had that rest too, over 2 weeks of rest. Mm-hmm. And they looked it on Saturday night, especially in the fourth quarter when they just outgassed Brown. So I do think the Cavaliers have their legs back underneath of them. You know, it's going to be fun, man. What a way to wrap up the quarterfinal weekend.
And exactly, Dixie, to go back to your point, and something we said even earlier was Schellenberger, you know, this is why he worries you as an opposing coach, because he doesn't need the ball in his stick all the time to make plays. You know, if you're Brett Makar, you can do an amazing job on Schellenberger, and Schellenberger can still have 3-3 or 2-4, or, you know, and I think somebody listed Schellenberger's all-time stats in the NCAA tournament, and they're incredible. You know, I think he has at least 6 points in every NCAA tournament game he's played. So that's something, you know, if you're Virginia, you can say, okay, Schellenberger's been quiet, but he doesn't, you know, you can shut him down for 95% of the game and he can still score 7 points.
All these games available on ESPNU. There's noon and 2:30 time slots on each of Saturday and Sunday. Make your plans now, and we'll be recapping these and talking about championship weekend the next time you hear us. All right, guys, it is time for the give and go. Dix, we've been talking about food a lot lately, last few weeks. It's time for some more pop culture type of stuff. I'm going to ask you now, we're late in the spring, what are you watching? What's happening in the Dixon household? I want to hear, Sweezy, your answer as well. But I'll start, as usual, give you guys some time to take some notes or think. But I've been watching three shows on Netflix. Ozark, haven't finished Ozark, but, you know, it's the series finale episodes, the second handful of the fourth season, I think. And I've watched a couple of those. It's one of the best shows ever. It's really good. I watch on AMC, and even some of the old episodes are available on Netflix, but I'm watching Better Call Saul. Just amazing. Just a great show. Well done. It's by the Breaking Bad team, if you haven't which is one of the best shows of all time. If you guys haven't followed Better Call Saul, it's sort of like the story that happens before Breaking Bad. And then show that I want to talk about that I've been watching. It's been four episodes so far. It's on HBO. We Own This City, which is a story about the Baltimore Gun Trace Task Force. And I remember this going down. I remember this happening. And it does. It's by the people who made The Wire. They understand Baltimore. They understand Baltimore police. They understand the city, the people. And it's an outstanding series. There's only six episodes. And they have four. That comes out on Monday nights. And I've watched all four of them. I even started watching the first one again. It jumps around in the storyline. You got to really follow chronologically. It leaps back and forth with the same characters. And you got to kind of pay attention to when they put up the little cues of when things are happening. And I know how this story ends, and I don't want to give anything away, but one of the wildest, craziest parts of the story hasn't happened yet. And it's going to happen in the next two episodes. And it's still a mystery as to why and how it took place. So it's a great show, and I highly recommend it to all of our listeners.
All right. So I haven't watched that yet, but I do want to watch it. But I did pass it, and I was amazed. Well, there's two things. One, I've been watching a lot of old Wire clips on YouTube, and I have to go back and rewatch The Wire. I'm starting to get into the camp of that might be the greatest show of all time. I've always kind of thought Sopranos was in that vein, and The Sopranos is still incredible, but The Wire, man, like the stuff I'm picking up on and remembering and being like, man, oh my God, you know. But Marlo Stanfield, the actor that played Marlo, is in We Built This City.
He plays Sean Suter. About half of The Wire's actors are in this.
Okay. Well, I saw
like,
Marlo.
Remember Jay Lansfield, like the real heavy set cop?
Oh, yeah. The big guy, like the.
He plays the commissioner. He plays like a Baltimore police commissioner in this one. It's just great seeing those people again in different roles. I mean, so many of them are in this new series.
Is he still that heavy?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
How about when I just saw the clip?
He's distinguished looking, you know?
I just saw the clip where Bunk and the heavy guy, they the one suspect, they said it was a lie detector. They just had his hand taped to a photocopy machine. That was brilliant. I was just like, good God. That just, oh man. But all right. So just finished a few weeks ago, my wife and I finished Last Kingdom. Unbelievable. What a great show. Destiny is all. That's all I can say. Please watch that show if you haven't
already. What a satisfying ending.
It was great. And Christian, do you watch this show, or have you watched it, or plan on watching it?
And I've not watched one show that you guys have mentioned. I don't watch much TV. I gave it up for Lent a couple of years ago, and I've never gone back. I watch sports occasionally and a little bit of political talk stuff, and then that's it.
Okay,
I'm sorry. People at work love Ozark, but I've never seen one second of any of these things. So I've never seen The Wire. I've never seen We Built This City or whatever it's called. So
The Wire was on 20 years
you need
ago.
You need to get the hell off this podcast, Christian. So spoiler alert. Okay. So anybody who wants to watch Last Kingdom, cut out now. All right. I thought Uhtred was going to die. I thought Uhtred was going to die to get Battenborough back and then give it to his daughter, you know, because you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Did you think he was going to fight it or no?
No, because I've read all the books and he makes it through like the 13th book. He's the narrator of the story, so he kind of has to make it through.
But this was the last season, last episode. Come on.
Well, there's a movie coming out too, and they can't have the movie without him.
Okay. So right now we are watching Ozark, two episodes left in that. It's been fantastic. I watched Winning Time, the show on HBO about the Los Angeles Lakers when Jerry Buss bought the team and then drafted Magic Johnson. That was cool. And I'm not a Laker fan, but I loved it.
How great is John C. Reilly as Jerry Buss?
He's perfect. And how about Jason Clarke as Jerry West? Just perpetually pissed off.
Jerry West is not happy about that portrayal. They put a cease and desist to HBO.
Yeah. And then Adrian Brody playing Pat Riley. That was. And I'm like, Pat Riley doesn't look like that. And then you go back and look at Pat Riley circa 1980, you're like, he looked exactly like that.
They showed, they were talking about Pat Riley during the Celtics Heat game last night, and they showed him at courtside, and he was yawning, and he's super gray hair now, and you're like, oh, okay. Okay, Pat.
Yeah. And then I'm curious if the relationship that was portrayed between Jerry Buss and Red Auerbach is actually like, you know, true, because Red Auerbach was a grade A butthole in that in the show. You should probably cut that out.
So it's in there. I mean, again, the Jerry West people, he's still alive and he's not happy about the way he was portrayed. So I don't know, maybe Red Auerbach, he just can't complain.
Yeah.
I am reading the book on which Winning Time is based by Jeff Perlman, and it's excellent so far. But it's a TV thing, so I'm out.
You ever meet Jeff Perlman? He's a Blue Hens grad. Yeah,
he's a Delaware guy. Yeah, he very kindly, we emailed back and forth when I was working on my book. We showed Baltimore, which is available on Amazon and Cornell Press, and the price has just gone down. And there's also an audio book coming out. We just signed the paperwork yesterday. So those who don't like to read or want to do a podcast, when this one is in hiatus in the off season, the audio book should be out hopefully in the next few months. But anyway, Jeff Perlman did direct me to someone, an old writer I was looking for, and he had the contact information right away. Very nice guy. I appreciated his help.
Nice. The third season of Barry is now happening on HBO. So we're watching Barry, and I watched, I don't know why I did this, but I guess I was just intrigued. There's two standalone TV shows on Netflix. One is about this guy who figured out how to play The Price is Right and got all the, like, knew all the, he basically created a computer algorithm to price all the items. So he would go to the studio and yell out the prices, and people started listening to him, and they were getting like the exact price on the bids. And then he went on and won as well. So that was pretty interesting. And then I ended up watching the show about Abercrombie and Fitch, the old clothing store. I hated that place when I was, you know, I guess it was like high school and college they were around, and I just thought it was a creepy place. And man, watch the show, and you'll be like, yeah, you'll be ashamed if you used to shop there, but you'll be really, really happy that you made the decision to stay out of that store if that's the way you went. But that was a really interesting show.
I'm intrigued now. I didn't know that a retail store chain could be so creepy.
It's crazy. Like, watch the show and you'll be like, wow, that was their business model. It's interesting.
Well, they did just disappear. I think isn't that kind of the gist of it? Is they were a popular brand and then they just went away.
But it wasn't as quick of a demise as you would think. That's the thing. It wasn't as quick of a demise as you might, you know, think you recall. It took a bit, but just the hits that the place took, you were like, wow, like they really thought they could get away with that.
like Flow Society. Remember those zany shorts that all the lacrosse kids were wearing?
I remember jams. I know the last time I saw Sweezy had a pair of jams on.
Amazing.
All right, good stuff, Dixie. I haven't seen Barry. I've never watched an episode of Barry. I think I need to check that out.
It's a really good show. Yeah. And it's the episodes are only a half hour long, so it's a lot like watching Schitt's Creek. You know, it goes really quick, but it's good entertainment. You should watch it, Christian. I know you don't watch TV, but you'd enjoy it.
Barry, good. Thank you.
He's like, what's HBO?
I actually don't have it, but I'm sure I can find it on Amazon Prime at some point.
Seems like a good place to stop. We'd like to thank our guest this week, Christian Sweezy, author of the book We Showed Baltimore, The Lacrosse Revolution of the 1970s, and Richie Moran's Big Red. It's available. You can get this book. It's a special price for our listeners, so go pick up the price. If you like what you've heard, please like us on your favorite podcast app and leave a review. Tell a friend and share the love. It's free. We always love to hear from you, so give us a shout out on Twitter. He's at Dixon Lacrosse, and I'm simply at D_FLY. And Christian, you are at?
Sweezy Lacrosse, all one word.
And remember, stay positive, test negative, and as always, enjoy the games.